This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. We're rebroadcasting a show that aired in October. It examined the high cost of living in Hawaii. My guests in studio, retired law professor and author Randy Roth, and noted economist Paul Brubaker of Tropic Zone Economics. For years, Paul has been beating the drum, warning that the median price of a home in Hawaii could hit $1 million by the end of the decade. And we're almost there.
It's kind of funny what people remember. When I was first talking about that, maybe 5 years ago, I thought we were going to have another housing cycle, a bubble in valuations, and so we would have gotten to $1 million faster. We haven't had that in the 20-teens. In fact, we've had very steady appreciation, so an escalator instead of a roller coaster. But at any rate of increase, you get to $1 million eventually from wherever you start. And so from 800,000, where single-family median home prices are on Oahu, we're a few years out from that, even at a low rate of appreciation.
To some folks, though, that's still the $1 million mark. It's just scary.
It's an illusion because it's $1 more than $999,999. And unfortunately, there's a lot of bad public policy making going on. They seem all to have consulted Dr. Evil from the Austin Powers movies, right? So there's all this stuff. People are always making thresholds that are $1 million. But it's really an arbitrary number. It's really important to think about the relative values relative to what they were over time and relative to what they are over space and other places that people live.
Some folks say, okay, $1 million gets you one home in Hawaii, maybe three in Vegas, one in Kansas. I don't know. Randy Roth,
four,
chime
four
in
here. Kansas.
Four in Kansas.
40 or 50 in my hometown. I'm from a little rural area, western Kansas, and the cost of living there is quite reasonable. The cost of housing is particularly affordable, but there aren't any jobs. There isn't outside capital. And so when we talk about the high cost of living in Hawaii and especially the high cost of housing, and we get into these issues of people from outside Hawaii coming in and buying properties and developers building properties specifically for very wealthy people from outside Hawaii, it seems to me it's there are a lot of moving parts in trying to understand just what's going on and to what extent it benefits us as a community and to what extent it doesn't. And just one of the things that I think needs to be part of that conversation is the value of outside capital, the value of people investing in construction or what have you, that creates jobs and management of properties that create jobs. So Paul is famous for having coined the term the paradise tax or the paradise premium. We kid about that.
Not true.
But as he points out, Hawaii is always going to be a relatively expensive place to live. Housing in Hawaii is always going to be relatively expensive. But I think he's helped us to talk about it intelligently by breaking those issues apart so that we're not just talking about the cost of living in Hawaii. Among other things, we're talking about the affordability. And I don't know, you had mentioned the escalator as opposed to the roller coaster. Help us understand how housing can be so expensive, and yet from the standpoint of your affordability index, it's in relatively good shape.
Yeah, that's Randy brings up some really good points, and it elaborates on this, what I like to call the space-time continuing, the context, which is both time and geography, essentially. If you look at prices at any moment in time, you will find consistently over time, and consistently if you compare Honolulu to lots of other cities, that prices are high. But they're also high in other cool cities like Hong Kong and Midtown Manhattan and much of coastal California. In fact, Hawaii's almost indistinguishable from most of coastal California. And those relatives are really important. The part of it, the relatives over space. The part of it that's important with respect to time is that when you're on a smooth glide path, as we have been this decade, where prices are rising about 4% on Oahu per annum, incomes are rising at about that rate or maybe a little higher in nominal terms, to subtract 2% inflation in either case, And interest rates are stable,
but going up.
Fortunately, low. Well, they're rising slowly now. They're normalizing, as the Federal Reserve would say. In that kind of environment, it's not really disruptive. You can make investment plans over time, long-term decisions. Unlike the situation when you have this roller coaster where home prices are doubling every 3 or 4 or 5 years, as was true in the late 1980s when the Price of Paradise gang got together, and again happened in the early 2000s with the so-called subprime bubble. And actually, we have seen other bubbles in housing valuations in Hawaii, notably in the 1970s. So in those environments, it's very disruptive for home prices to be moving at 20% or 25% per year because there's no way income's keeping up. And in the past, we had higher interest rates, and we've been helped by 30 years of interest rates subsiding to something that's manageably low. They're going to stay relatively low. But in those periods, the huge disruption created, you know, massive upheaval, people leaving the islands. The rapid rise in prices was kind of a signal to real estate speculators to jump in and flip this house or, right, flip this a'alava. And so you see a lot of inefficient investment behavior. Too much of this and too much of that is built, and then the buildings are left twisting in the wind. This is a much more kind of sane environment we've found ourselves in Hawaii. And my guess is that it's going to stay a lot more like this, notwithstanding the fact that rates are rising. You're absolutely right. Mortgage rates are closer to 4.5% to 5% now than they were, you know, a year ago or for most of this decade. And they'll probably go to 5.25%, maybe 5.5% in the next 12 months. That's sort of the outer bound of what you'd expect given what the Federal Reserve is saying and given what markets are saying.
So you're saying we're pretty stable. We're
pretty stable, yeah. And the loss of affordability in terms of housing right now is coming entirely from rising interest rates, the modest increase in interest rates, not a rapid increase in home prices.
And I know there are folks that are nervous because you've watched the economy and the stock market just keep going, and they're saying, well, that can't keep going at the same pace, and something's got to give. And then there's a concern, okay, what if, let's say, something, there's a big crash?
Well,
and then what?
Actually, it could, unless somebody screws something up, like starts a trade war or something like that. So, undermines the credibility of the FBI, the Supreme Court, and the Federal Reserve. So, yeah, I mean, we're on a very stable sort of ascending trajectory. There's a slowdown happening globally, and yes, we should be worried about that. But the thing you really worry about is something just, you know, blowing it up.
Right. And Randy, we were talking earlier before the show, and you were thumbing through your books. And where do you think we're at as far as the price of paradise with 25, 26 years later?
Well, it's interesting. The Price of Paradise books were written in the early 1990s, and most of the contributing authors were at UH as faculty members or had a connection to the University of Hawaii. There were some others. But largely from the University of Hawaii. And we tried to address in a way that everybody could understand what we considered the key issues of the day, including those issues that a community never really resolves. It's always out there in one form or another. And especially because we were on one of those roller coasters that Paul mentioned at that time. The cost of living in Hawaii was about 40% above the national average at that time. I didn't realize until I looked at the book again, Paul, that we had peaked at 40%. In 1970s, it was 20%, and this year statewide, according to the U.S. Commerce Department, it's about 18%. Yeah. So we've always had a higher cost of living in Hawaii than the average on the mainland. But one of the things, as I was thumbing through the book and reading the various authors' attempt to talk about this in understandable ways, one of the points that really jumped out at me was this notion that if somehow magically we ever got the cost of living in Hawaii down, the cost of living to where it was truly, literally affordable, that people could buy the home where they want to live and not have three jobs or whatever it might be, that a lot of people would move to Hawaii, that it's our high cost of living and our extremely expensive housing that prevents a lot of people who would like to live here, prevents them from coming here. And so, in a way, as much as we hate the high cost of living and the high cost of housing, prices play a role in preserving Hawaii. And so it's a tension that will just never go away. And how we deal with it as a community, how we balance all of these various interests, trying to have a solid economy and trying to have, you know, investment, outside investment, so that we're creating jobs and what have you, but not ruining what causes this to be such a special place.
You know, I think, Paul, the last time we were here, we had talked about the economy and what was happening with tourism. And you had a snapshot of a comparison of where we're at now and where we were, you know, a few decades back.
Well, let's not get too far off on this because it's a huge subject. But it turns out this year will probably be the first year in 30 years that total tourism receipts have returned to where they were in 1989, which is the all-time high. We've got 4 million more visitors arriving in Hawaii today than we did 30 years ago. But for a variety of reasons, over the last 30 years, it's been much choppier. It's been up and down for expenditures, mostly down, and now in the last decade maybe up to get us back to where we started. And so there's a big issue, if you think twice about that, because, you know, we thought we were focused on more dollars, not more visitors, and it turns out it worked out the other way around. This is a separable issue, but it does add to something, the problem that Randy alludes to, because when your principal export isn't really earning more than it was decades ago, but you're having to handle larger and larger volumes, the untoward outcomes, the congestion and the you know, aggressive utilization of resources, natural resources, whatnot, environmental untoward environmental outcomes. You know, those are real costs. And so, as Randy says, it's important to distinguish between the policy interventions, right? You can have a completely different conversation, for example, about what the appropriate property tax rate should be versus the cost of living as an equilibrating mechanism that balances the net migration inflows and outflows, and that balances the net movements of capital as well as labor. We live in a highly mobile society. We designed the United States so that you're free to move around the cabin. And that's one of the benefits of this country that the Europeans aspire to and that other places wish they had. And but there, you know, the consequences of being a desirable place to live, as Randy points out, is that it tends to bid up the values of the fixed assets. There's no more real estate being produced outside of the East Rift of Kilauea Volcano, and that's not working out for people that chose to live there. And so the desirability is itself a reason behind the relatively high living, the 1.2 proportion of our costs to the sort of the average urban living cost across the country.
Well, you know, if you're just joining the conversation, we're talking about our housing prices and our ability to meet the economic demands of living in this island state. You know, Paul, I was at a forum at a Palolo Neighborhood Board, and they had a discussion about monster homes, and there were folks, you know, saying that the problem is kind of intertwined because you've got a lot of folks that are coming from the outside that have bought homes here as an investment. I think it was here was 25%. I think Maui is up to 50%. And there's just the concern that, you know, most folks who are living here, most residents, are just having a hard time making ends meet. And so you're seeing these monster homes. Folks are trying to make find ways to make a living and pay their mortgage. So it's all kind of intertwined. I mean, I don't know. What's your take on what's happening out there?
Well, there are a lot of moving parts to those issues, and obviously you've got, you know, the need for zoning and then the enforcement of zoning. When you talk about people coming from the outside, whether we think of foreign people or just non-residents, it's a natural human condition, if you will, that we would like them to pay more. Whether we think they're paying enough already or not, let's have them chip in some more. But as Paul mentioned, the country has been set up in such a way that we don't control the flow of people coming in or out, and there are real restrictions on our ability to structure taxes in such a way that target non-residents or target non-citizens or whatever that category might be. Here on Oahu, we've got the Residence A category, where people who aren't living in the house they own incur a higher rate for property tax purposes. The Big Island has something, probably all the counties have something along those lines. They need continually to be looking at to see whether that extra amount that a non-resident owner, who could be somebody from Hawaii, but they're just not living in that house, they need to revisit that from time to time, whether that extra amount is enough or too much or what have you. But that's already in place at the county level. Lately, the discussion of that has been in the context of this proposed constitutional amendment that would give the state the authority to start taxing real property. And on the surface of this conversation, people are talking about, well, the proceeds are supposed to go to education. There is no guarantee of that, and I think there is no likelihood of that. And they're saying it's only going to apply to non-resident, as in not from Hawaii, wealthy people. No way. The way it's been designed, and it was not an accident, is that it would involve a new tax on any investment real property. And Paul can tell you, you buy your own home that you're going to live in, and that's an investment in real property. That the legislature would use such a flexible term like that, I think, was not an accident. So this recent conversation is, should we give the state the ability to start taxing real property so that we can get outsiders to pay more for education or whatever it might be? I think that whole message has been so jumbled, and I think it's such a bad idea what's been proposed. It's not to say that public education isn't something we need to take a harder look at and find a better way to support than we have in the past, but this constitutional amendment proposal, in my opinion, is just a very bad idea. And it is not what it purports on the outside to be.
Well, that came up at this forum because of the low property taxes, and that was what was attracting people to come in here and buy investment property. At the same time, I've had conversations with people, you know, talking about, and it's one of the issues that we've been seeing on TV, the ads about, oh, all my kids have left because they can't afford to live here and buy a home here. And so then we're left by ourselves because all our, you know, our children and grandchildren are on the mainland. And so what do? Do we move and do we sell our house and then it becomes, you know, or do we just rent it out? It becomes investment property.
That's Paul and I both have a bunch of kids on the mainland. Paul, talk about that.
Well, my boys are all in Denver, so I need to backpedal a little and unpack and call some things out here, because I feel even more strongly than Randy does about this. With respect to the, my kids moved to the mainland. Dude, we all went to the mainland, right? We all went to the mainland to get education, to get experience, and some of us came back, and don't tell me about the brain drain, because it's not that the smart guys left and the dumb guys, the bucks for Lolos came back. But you just described every town in America. Every town in America, every place I've ever lived in this country, people talk about, oh, the children are all moving away, blah, blah, boo-hoo, here's the world's smallest violin playing sad music. So that, I don't even think that's a thing. Migration is good for the United States and for the world, for that matter. And efficient allocation of labor and capital and information is productivity enhancing. It was what makes this country great.
So you don't think we should be fretting so much?
Nah, take a chill pill. And by the way, it's not even new. Hello. Okay. Second, so I'm going to come down a little more sharply than Randy did. Randy's too polite. I'm going to call out tribalism where I see it now. And I think it's rampant. And it's, you know, I'm not talking about right-wing, neo-nationalists, racist, whatever. I'm talking about, you know, I supposedly live in the one-party state of the People's Republic of Hawaii, where there's like one party, the Democratic Party, and they think they're so progressive and liberal. And we do tribalism like nowhere else. You know what I mean? So Here, check this out. When was the last time the State of Hawaii Department of Education built a school? I mean, do they even know how to build schools? Didn't all those guys retire? Because as far as I can tell, the only people who build schools today are developers that the state jacks schools out of, right? You want to build a housing subdivision, you got to kick in a school. So we make the new people, we make the new homeowners pay for schools. How's that for tribalism, you know? And then all this jazz about, ooh, they're building monster homes. There's an old joke, right? If it's a recession when you're unemployed, but it's a depression when I'm unemployed. Okay, so by the same token, right, it's a monster house when it's being built next door to mine. But if it's my house, it's an accessory dwelling unit. It's our Ohana unit. So my family, you know, kind of, come on. All right, you got to separate who the investor is from what the investment is. And if you can't do that, if you can't keep those two things separated, then I'm calling you out for tribalism. Right? It doesn't matter who the investor is, where it comes from, or whatever. If you have a problem with the property tax rate, and I think you should, by the way, because it used to be three times higher, but the last couple of housing bubbles, when the price of housing went up, everybody called up their council person and said, oh, I didn't know the price was going to go up, lower my property tax. And so those morons did. And so now they've reduced the property tax to one-third of what it was 40 years ago, and you can't go into a public park bathroom because it hasn't been cleaned in 6 months. So, hey, you get what you pay for, right? You guys ask for it. Don't come to the Palolo community meeting and tell me how, oh, property taxes are so low. You ask for that. Okay. It's a democracy.
Paul, I wish you'd just tell them what's on your mind.
Yeah.
Quit dancing.
We do have a caller, Wayne from Mililani. But before we go to him, a quick reminder, today's show is a rebroadcast, so no new calls are being taken.
Hi, so I'm wondering if the panelists have any of the numbers and figures they've been talking about take into consideration the lower salaries that people make in Hawaii. Median home prices have been compared to L.A., New York, San Francisco, but there's a fair amount of well-paying jobs in those cities. People in Hawaii, from what I've noticed, don't tend to get paid comparable wages. And when you factor in the higher cost of living, what people actually have to work with at the end of every month is it's considerably less than whatever anyone makes in, say, San Francisco or in L.A. or New York.
Yeah, one of the chapters in the second Price of Paradise book, we did exactly that. We talked about how housing has always been more expensive. The cost of living has always been more expensive. But especially with groups of people who have more formal education as opposed to less formal education, people in Hawaii on average make less than their counterparts elsewhere. Other than people who work for the federal government, I don't think there's a category of professional person in Hawaii, and I say professional person because that's at the far end of the education, formal education scale. I don't think there's a category that comes close on average to making they would need to make to compensate for the higher cost of living, and many of them make significantly less than the average on the mainland. So it's a double barrel whammy, if you will, that we not only have really high costs of housing and living generally, but for many people, especially those with in the categories of jobs where it takes more of a formal education, the amount they make is even less than the average elsewhere.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Often referred to as paradise, Hawaii's gorgeous weather, beauty, and relaxed lifestyle comes at a price. We're rebroadcasting a previously recorded show that looked at the price of paradise. Our guests in studio, economist Paul Brubaker and retired law professor and author Randy Roth. If you have a comment you want to share, call the talkback line 808-792-8217. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a break. If you're just joining us, our guests in the studio are retired law professor and author Randy Roth and Honolulu economist Paul Brubaker of TZ Economics. Today's show is a rebroadcast, so no new calls are being taken. Paul, you wanted to chime in on the question that we have of caller.
Wayne
from Mililani.
Wayne, good question. And it's important to quantify because it really clarifies. So you can go to UHERO's website, and or you can go to the National Association of Realtors websites and website and see how these kinds of housing affordability indices are calculated. But basically, you put the mortgage rate, the median four-person family income, and the median home price into a blender, and then you can track over time how things have been. And in Hawaii right now, Honolulu in particular, Oahu is currently at one of the better relative positions that we've been in over time. And, you know, a good time is the 20-teens. Bad time would have been about 2006. Good time in 1998. You know, moments you should have bought a house.
Thanks for telling us now.
Now that I know. 1990 was a bad time. That's why we were writing the Price of Paradise chapters. And then about, you know, 5 years before that, 1985 would have been sort of your last moment to make a good bet on relatively cheap housing. But so yes, some of these things are measured, and yes, income is taken into account even in the formal measures. Wayne asked an even deeper question, which is whether God should reward us in addition for it being Hawaii by having our incomes be equal to what our incomes would have been in Madison, Wisconsin, which is a nice town, by the way. I went to graduate school there. But everything is cheap, and everybody has two houses, one up on a lake in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and the other down in Madison. And, yeah, in that case, you know, the problem that Randy was talking about is really important to understand. People live here, yes. More highly educated persons have higher lifetime earnings. That's the fact, Jack. But in Hawaii, even when you are one of those persons and might have an expectation of a higher income in a place like Midtown Manhattan or Santa Clara County, California, you're not going to get it because Hawaii is cooler. I mean, that we reveal our preferences. Some of us live in Midtown. Some of us live in Santa Clara County. We suck it up and pay whatever the housing costs are there. And some of us have lived in Wisconsin, which was awesome. I loved it. But you know what? The winter was a little long. And at the end of the day, when it worked out for me to come home, that's what I did. I knew I could have made, I presume I could have made more money other places. But part of the compensation, this is the important thing to remember, part of the compensation of being here is the fact that it's like it is here, culturally, environmentally, and so on. And people have a willingness to pay or a willingness to accept lower compensation as a consequence of those amenities. You'd find that true in a lot of places, by the way. That's not unique to Hawaii. But I think it's a big factor in Hawaii. And for somebody like my sons, who are all in their 20s and 30s, and, you know, one is in enterprise cybersecurity. I don't even know what that is. And the other is he's going to get an MBA. And yes, he could have gotten one here, but he's going to go to CU instead. I mean, we all move around for those reasons. And I don't think we should lament that. I really think you have to let go on that particular issue. But on this important issue, why don't you get paid more in Hawaii? I think it's unreasonable to expect that one should necessarily, when the non-wage amenities comprise the package that they really do. And I'm actually surprised that people like people in federal government employment and elsewhere have made the argument that they should be paid as much. Because I'm like, it's not the same as in Honolulu as it is in Madison, Wisconsin. And Madison's a cool town.
Randy, you want to chime in there?
I agree with everything Paul just said.
We do have a call on the line, Brenda from Honolulu. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. I just wanted to correct a misconception that was said earlier. I work for the Department of Education Facilities Development Branch, and I was on my way back from a meeting and heard Paul say that developers built schools, that the DOE hasn't built a new school. That's not actually true. Large developers provide land, but the funding comes through the legislature with CIP bonds. the DOE spent about $45 million to build Ho'okele Elementary School, which opened in 2016. Currently, we're spending over $59 million to build the first phase of East Kapolei Middle School. So developers have not been building schools for us, although that would be great if anyone out there wants to do that.
All right. Thank you, Brenda.
Yeah, you go, girl. So I concede the point up to the observation that developers have to give the land. So you're not, that sounds like we're not even paying fully for the schools, right? I mean, the land's not free, so why is it treated as free? My point is, once upon a time, the state built schools. I went to public school here, and I'm pretty sure this idea that developers, as an exaction, as a condition for development, should be compelled to kick in something as an optimal bribe to get approval for the development.
I think there was a time when they were doing the second city, and they sat down and the large property owners at the time, I think, put aside some land for schools out on the Kapolei side.
That was
a while ago.
But no, it's a standard practice that as a condition of development, there's an exaction. Okay, that's a tax or a bribe, depending on your point of view.
Well, and it raises a really important point that Paul touched on earlier, and that is, as you have various things being done by the government that make it harder and harder for developers to make money on projects that they would like to do, you can end up with less building. And Paul, I think your comment earlier was that we have a real problem with housing. It's always going to cost more here than most other places, but it doesn't have to be in such short supply. Could you talk a little bit about
that? Yeah, sure. And I don't want to undermine, what was her name? She made a really good
point.
Brenda makes a really good point. It's costly to do this and to build schools. My point just was that if we're shifting the burden of that cost from the general public by, say, exacting land from a developer as a condition of a housing development to be contributed towards the development of a new school, then we're really shifting portions of that cost of the new school to the new homeowners, away from the existing homeowners. And as Randy points out, anytime you load additional cost onto new housing supply, it makes it more expensive to deliver. The problem of housing, what's happened is I think we've conflated a problem of housing affordability, which is a problem because it's Hawaii, it's always going to be more expensive, blah, 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 blah. And there are other reasons. Geography and regulation make housing more costly. Steep slopes and water bodies distinguish home building on Oahu from home building in Kansas. But the regulatory environment is also distinctive in Hawaii. I mean, it's so onerous a burden that it's off the charts compared to other jurisdictions.
Well, the DOE is looking at building schools like in the Kaka'ako area and somehow combining the two, so you get a high rise with some residential with the school down on the ground floor.
This kind of astonishes me because building a school on the most expensive urban land in Honolulu can't be cheap if you think about it for a second. And this idea that families are moving into Kaka'ako to live in high-rise condominiums, to me, seems really odd. In the first place, if you talk to the developers, one of the developers likes to talk about, sort of informally, about the fact that we build at the front of the house. It's kind of a joke, right? We build at the front of the house. We all live at the back of the house, but we build at the front of the house. So I don't know. I think these problems of housing regulation and development have gotten so complicated that we've lost sight of really simple ideas like young families generally don't live in the most expensive, high-density neighborhoods and urban cores. If that's the direction we're going, and I think higher density is the direction urbanization on Oahu has to go. I mean, I thought we were done with suburban sprawl 20 years ago. Evidently not. Then, yes, some of those solutions have to be found that are less costly than building at the front of the house.
Okay, now we're going to take a call from the Big Island. And a quick reminder, today's show is a rebroadcast. Feel free to record your comments on our talkback line, 792-8217. Next up, Turk from Volcano Village.
Hi.
What's your question?
Yeah, I just have a couple points I want to make. I'm a retired professional. I live over here in Volcano on the Big Island. I lived in Honolulu since the 70s, and I retired here in 2006. And you can still build a piece of paradise over here. You can get a piece of land and build a beautiful home and still have a very good, comfortable living. So, the fact is that the cost of living on Oahu is just really getting out of sight with the housing prices, and I don't see that that's going to help anything as far as homeless and so forth. But as my other point is, when I lived in Arizona, they told us that they couldn't pay us what we were worth because that was the price of paradise. And I've heard that in other places when I was stationed in the military in Florida and Texas. They call it paradise. So, you know, paradise is a state of mind, and I don't think that's really an appropriate mentality. I think it's a corporation, a plantation mentality, trying to keep the workers down, make them think that they're living well in without paying them what they're worth. So anyway, those are my 2 points. And like I said, I'm a retired professional, and I live over here, and I live well. You can still live in Hawaii and have a good life. For me, I could see people selling their homes over there in Honolulu and buying one over here and then pocketing the other $500,000. You know, Kona's kind of expensive. But, you know, on the Hilo side, it's much nicer and much more affordable.
All right.
So
those
are my comments.
Thank you so much, Turk. Randy?
Well, something Paul said earlier reminded me, you know, we have this huge issue right now of vacation rentals. And it just seems like we're not really dealing with that directly. The city talks about doing one thing. I'm not sure the enforcement is there. The state seems to come at it from another angle. I'm not sure the enforcement's there. I'm curious what our resident economist thinks about vacation rentals. It's obviously not a simple issue, or it would have been solved by now.
We've got 15 minutes to come back to that, which is really important that we do. So if I could put a placeholder on that, because the caller just made 2 really important points that I think are worth elaborating on. He mentioned, I believe, either his affiliation with or employment by the military. There's a famous case, actually, 30 years ago when Price of Paradise was going on, when Senator Inouye and Senator Stevens from Alaska were able to segregate federal employees in Hawaii and Alaska from the non-contiguous from the contiguous 48 states when the Federal Office of Personnel Management was attempting to move away from pay that had these regional cost of living adjustments towards what they called locality pay, where they looked at prevailing wages in the communities around them. And as the caller points out, in some communities, he mentioned Arizona, but I don't want to pick on anybody. In some communities where unions are less prevalent and or so-called right-to-work states where that countervailing power is less prevalent, there has been a tendency for workers maybe not to have achieved what some of the industrial trade unions did for workers in other parts of the country. I don't want to lean too heavily on that, but this observation about the role that corporations and unions and, you know, the nature of negotiating power between workers and employers is an important issue. And I don't have a real generalization to make about Hawaii in that sense. I think we're past the plantation era. But to go back to this point about locality pay, the two senators set up this arrangement that isolated Hawaii and Alaska federal workers so that they could receive a substantial cost of living adjustment, which was rooted in the kinds of ratios Randy alluded to earlier, 1.2 or so, and at the time of Price of Paradise, closer to 1.35, 1.4. And I was actually interviewed to be the expert witness. They didn't like what I had to say because I was saying mostly what I was saying now, which was that, well, it's 1.4 for 5 minutes, and then it'll be 1.2. The second point that the caller made that's really interesting is that the neighbor islands tend to be less expensive than Honolulu. That's just saying that the country's cheaper than, you know, living in Iowa is cheaper than living in downtown Chicago. But it is an important point because there is mobility, and we observe it you see a pattern of net domestic migration from Oahu to the Niue Islands. It's been consistent. It's been going on for decades. And that's not contradicted by the observation that we have people out of state moving to the neighbor islands at higher rates, and it's a higher proportion of the resident population than you see on Oahu. So it's possible for all these things to coexist. In fact, we have measures of this. So you can look up purchasing power parity, which is a new Bureau of Economic Analysis measure of relative living costs. And you will see in those data that the neighbor islands are relatively cheap compared to Oahu, and they're cheaper for the reasons that the caller pointed out. Housing, which is much more expensive on Oahu. I just go back to a point Randy introduced, which is that the jobs associated with urban environments tend to have more opportunity in a variety of dimensions, not the least of which is compensation, than typically is found in rural areas.
This is The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today's show is a rebroadcast, so no new calls are being taken. If you have a comment you want to share, call the talkback line, 808-792-8217. Now going to Scott in Honolulu.
Two quick questions. One is, what's the status of the transit-oriented development corridor that so much planning has been going into, but yet, to my knowledge, no infrastructure has been put in yet, and I don't know how long it's going to be before the rail is operative to Middle Street, which many of the people I know want to stop it at Middle Street and get it operating. What's going on in the TOD? The second question is, why can we not in this year, 2018, revisit the building requirements on family dwellings and do away with the double wall construction? I know that's all regulated, but anyway, that's my two questions. What can you tell us about getting homes, whether they're high rises or single family or a combination of both, the infrastructure in on the TOD, getting the rail line operative to Middle Street, and that's another debate, but that and the building requirements that we could maybe build less expensive single wall, single family dwellings.
Thank you, Scott. I know that there would be some folks who would be concerned just about the strength of a home in a hurricane, about single wall, just because the building codes exist and are upgraded for good reason.
You know, Paul and I disagree on so few things, but rail happens to be one of them. So the easy answer to Scott's first question is that they need to stop rail at Middle Street, although Paul may feel differently about that. I think it's fair to say that transit-oriented development, at least thus far, has not worked out nearly the way the proponents of rail had projected years ago. The jury's still out, and like I say, Paul might have some more positive things to say about rail than I would. On the other one, I happen to know a local developer who has put together a little hui that's worked out some proposed changes to the building code that I think does a good job of balancing interests like not having the house blow away in a hurricane on the one hand, with trying to bring down the cost of construction on the other, because I think we really need to work hard at doing those sorts of things. I don't have the expertise to know whether what they're proposing is good, bad, or indifference, but I really respect their ability, their experience, their intentions, and I know they're working with, on Oahu here, with the city in trying to find that nice balance, and I really respect that, and I'm very optimistic that that's going to help in some form to bring down the cost of housing. But like I say, my friend Mr. Brubaker may have something different about rail than what I shared with you.
No, I'm not gonna make a federal case about it. I'm concerned about how long it's taken and how little of what I thought was the rationale for an urban rail system has been achieved. So, and I joke about this, but the mayor will remember this. 10 years ago, we were at a party, and he was thinking about running for mayor because he was the managing director. And I said, "Dude, you got to own this slogan. It's not TOD. It's not transit oriented development. It's development oriented transit. It's about where you build housing in the 21st century." And Randy's concern is that we haven't even begun the development part, and it's costing us a gazillion dollars to not have any development. I mean, there are no condos being built at any train stations, as far as I know. And we're supposed to wait because that's going to happen. My point is, it's the other way around, right? The train station is supposed to be a retail galleria with a 30-story condo on top of it. Let's leave the train, the choo-choo train, to the side. I would also add that I'm thinking that building it in the inundation zone of future sea rise maybe isn't that intelligent either. To Randy's really important reflection on the caller's comments about the building code, I mentioned, two sort of basic reasons why housing is expensive in Hawaii, in addition to the fact that demand is high. Demand is high because it's Hawaii, so people want to be here, notwithstanding the fact we don't get paid as much as if we'd lived somewhere else. But the way you mitigate the problem of high demand is to increase supply, is to enable, to make it possible to build more housing more easily, faster, and therefore cheaper. And we demonstrably have moved in the opposite direction of that aspiration since the mid-20th century. In the quarter century from 1950 to the mid-1970s, we built 7,000 housing units per year on Oahu. And in the 20-teens, we've built about 2,500 units per year. Or maybe that's just Oahu. My point is that it's a really small number. It was 14,000 units per year when I graduated from Kailo High School, 14,000 units, new units per year on Oahu in the early 1970s. So we've clearly moved in a different direction. And you can't blame geography, steep slopes, and water bodies for that reduction. We did that, the politics of NIMBY, anti-growth, anti-development, political movements, which notwithstanding their deeply rooted concern over stewardship of the aina and so on. And so how you get that regulatory environment finessed so that we're not overburdening the builders of homes with unduly expensive attributes like double-walled insulated construction at the same time that you're tying it down so it doesn't blow away in the next hurricane, is not an easy matter. Maybe the pendulum has swung too far in one direction. I can say from what I know about this that most of that cost loading is actually in the price of the land, not right. The structure. And so you can't change geography, but you can, mitigate some of the cost loading from the regulatory environment we've created.
I know there's lots to cover. We wanted to hit vacation rentals. We only have a couple of minutes left. Any final thoughts, Randy?
I've really enjoyed this. we had the old Price of Paradise. We had the books and then the radio show. And Paul and I worked together a great deal back in those days, and we get together occasionally now. But I really think people like Paul are a treasure for this community. There are so many people with great expertise and experience who have an interest in the issues of today. And I think programs like this that get them talking out loud so the public can hear them, I think is wonderful. And it's kind of rejuvenating my interest in The Price of Paradise. Maybe we need to do a new Price of Paradise book.
Volume 3, there you go.
Yeah, thank you, Randy. Your check's in the mail. And we should definitely do volume 3. Let me just, a 20-second comment about vacation rentals. So among the ways the world has changed is that there's an app for that. The apps have reduced the cost of information asymmetries. We don't know, where to stay, or we don't know where to live. And that cat's out of the bag. So we need to get used to it. My brother, when he's not living with my dad, he's a sort of kind of semi-retired aerospace engineer, lives in an Airbnb wherever he wants. So are we going to, I'm just saying the world has changed in a particular way. We need to embrace it. There's an accessory dwelling unit being turned into an undocumented vacation rental in a neighborhood like yours.
Okay, suck it up.
I'm sorry.
All right, that happened. Down. Suck it up.
This has been a rebroadcast of our Price of Paradise show, originally aired in October. We'd like to thank our guests, Paul Brubaker and Randy Roth. And we thank you, the listener, for joining us. We weren't taking any live calls today, but if you have something to add to the discussion, call our talkback line and leave your comments. That number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you want to listen back to the show, check out the conversation archive audio at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for another edition of The Conversation.